personal moral compass. I think even Jesus would pick up his skirts and run the opposite direction if he saw my mother coming. My stomach drops when I think about this news coming to light, and how it will be portrayed. Of course, I knew there'd be no escaping public conjecture about River, but I haven't considered the best way for it to go public in the first place. I've always believed that my sex life and sexual history is no one's business. But that freaking questionnaire stripped away that delusion. The media will be just as interested, more so. To them, everything is possible news fodder, and nothing is sacred. The number one thing they'll want to know, who's the daddy? 5 years ago, I scrawled unknown on the form. I didn't care how it looked to leave that line blank on his birth certificate. For myself, I still don't care. But for River? How will that affect him? I'll have to control it, and the best way to do that is Rowena. Everything has been turned into the court. Questionnaires, criminal background checks, and drug tests. Thank God it's been months since I smoked a joint, and years since I tried anything stupider. Norman urged out-and-out candor about everything. The shoplifting to spite Mom at 14, the random recreational drug use, the abundant underage drinking, my sex life. The real one and the publicized one. Lord knows there's probably detailed evidence of every one of my sins somewhere. If I lie, something is sure to come back and bite me in the ass. Now, according to Norman, we wait. Before we leave his office, he asks us to give him character references. Three related, three non-related. Kylie and Kelly are going on my related list. And grudgingly, I decide my father would be better than my mother, given a choice between them. And Catherine agrees. Daddy. There's a fun phone call for later. I doubt he'll be pleased, but Kelly is pregnant, so it's not like impending grandfatherhood could induce heart failure. I have no idea if he and wife number four plan to propagate, but with three ex-wives and five children, one would think he'd feel kind of been there, done that by now. On the other hand, whenever he wants an empty nest, all he has to do is leave. I nearly draw a blank on the three non-related sources, because the first person to come to mind is Graham. But, of course, we are not speaking. I stare at the form in my lap, swallowing the hot mix of guilt and grief. I print Michonne Grant and copy her contact information from my phone. She's the only actress in my age range for whom I have both respect and a working phone number. I add Dana Scatio, the director of Hearts Over Manhattan. She loves me, and, bonus, was my most recent boss, of sorts. What about Janelle, my agent? I ask. Note to self, I need to inform Janelle about River. Norman frowns.
She's an option, if you can't think of anyone else.
His expression says, that can't possibly be true, can it?
Technically, she works for you and has a vested interest in getting you what you want. So she's deemed a less reliably candid source. The caseworker will likely contact her when they do the sweep through everyone with whom you've had substantial interaction. These six are merely the ones you deem most likely to give a favorable, yet realistic, depiction of you.
I'm gripping the pen in my hand so hard that the metal clip bites into my palm, and my world goes a bit fuzzy at the edges. Sorry, but did you just say they're going to speak with everyone? In what's left of my peripheral vision, Catherine's head pops up. Her gaze swings between Norman and me, and both she and Glenn have stopped writing. I'm sure they're both having a tough time narrowing down to six people who will speak favorably of them.
Family, work relationships, close friends, ex-boyfriends, I'm afraid so.
Norman regards me kindly from behind his folder-buried desk.
Not to worry. They don't expect you to be perfect or universally loved.
Universally loved? Can there be anything in the history of catchphrases that applies to me less?
Oh, God. They conduct these interviews to evaluate whether A, you're truthful, and B, You've got no detrimental personality disorders, anything that might prevent you from being a dependable parent to the child. It's all about his best interest, as I've said. I know you're tired of me saying that phrase, but it's what matters to the court. Best to get accustomed to it early on. Oh, my God. They're going to call both of my parents. My ex-stepmothers and ex-stepfathers, they're most likely going to call Reed. And they're definitely going to call Graham. Hello? Emma's voice is exactly as I expected, clipped, cold. Emma, this is Brooke, I reply needlessly. She obviously recognizes my number. Silence. Okay. I'm calling, I close my eyes, to ask a favor. She sputters a little. A favor? What would Graham's mom call it? How cheeky of you. But since Kara isn't around, I'll just say how goddamned presumptuous of you. What do you want, Brooke? What do I want? I want to hang up. Last year I made a huge miscalculation where Emma was concerned, where Graham was concerned. I never said anything to either of them afterward, of course. Never tried to account for what I did, or beg forgiveness. I knew I was automatically evicted from his life. I didn't need to hear him say it. I rarely apologize. It's not that I think I'm never wrong. I just don't care to admit it out loud. The only time I say I'm sorry is when there is literally no other way around saying it, or to get out of penalties that are possible to circumvent. Most consequences stick. That's why they're called consequences. 8 months ago, there was no evading Graham's banishment. And my way around a pointless I'm sorry was avoidance, plain and simple. If I take that approach now, I could lose River. I take a breath and square my shoulders. I need to talk to Graham. Of all the... Emma, I'm sorry. I fucked up. I totally fucked up. I wouldn't bother you, either of you. And look, I'm calling your phone, not his. I'm asking your permission. I'm begging you for it, please. My voice splinters at the end of this appeal, the last word sounding more like a sob. Fucking hell. More silence. Are you dying or something? She asks. And I can't tell if she sounds more hopeful or regretful at the prospect. Not yet. What do you mean, not yet? I'm not... This isn't about me as such. Well, it's only about me secondarily. It's about... my son. Your what? The baby I gave up for adoption. His adoptive father died, and his mother turned into a meth addict, and now he's in foster care, and I'm trying to get him out. Way to go, Brooke. That wasn't word vomit. That was word projectile vomiting. Does Reed know? She says his name as though they've been in contact, which I suppose is possible. Maybe she was part of his 12-step apology fest last month. He knows. He's not involved, which is fine. This is my choice. When I told you about the pregnancy, I sigh, I only told you so you'd hate him. But he was just a kid. I was just a kid. I'm not asking him for anything now, but yes, he's aware. Stop talking. We're even sort of getting along. It's kind of weird, actually. Stop talking. Huh. I roll my eyes, remembering how Graham and I had an infuriating conversation once upon a time about Emma and how she said, huh, whenever she couldn't think of anything else to say. He thought it was so adorable, and I wanted to gag him with a knee sock. I'll talk to him. No promises. He'll call you if he wants to talk. If he doesn't, he won't call. I grit my teeth, feeling powerless. I understand. Thank you. Goodbye, Brooke. After we disconnect, I pull up the photo of River I scanned into my phone and sent to Reed. Every time I look at it, I feel more overwhelmed, more terrified I'm going to fuck this up, and more sure that I can't let that happen. If I have to go around Emma to beg Graham not to ruin this, I'll do it. But I'm patient enough to bide my time and wait, and hope she doesn't hate me as much as I deserve to be hated. If our positions were reversed, I'd have told her to fuck off and blocked her from Graham's phone. But
Emma is not me. And that's just one more reason why Graham is hers and not mine.
Chapter 12. Reed. I have the driver drop me a block away from the Starbucks on the corner, pulling the beanie over my ears and hunching into my jacket before grabbing my shoulder duffel. It's dark out, so I can't wear my sunglasses, but it's not like anyone expects Reed Alexander to pop up here, either. Even if I'm recognized, most people will merely assume I bear an uncanny resemblance to that one guy from that movie. 9 tomorrow morning? I say, opening the door, and he nods. Yes, sir? I didn't realize how much I'd miss the sight of her until I see her. She sent a text 15 minutes ago to tell me she'd arrived and staked out a chair on the second level. I was supposed to call her when I got there, but I didn't. I wanted this moment. I hoped she'd be caught up in reading, not looking for me, that I could take a few precious seconds to drink her in, that I'd get to witness the exact moment she notices I'm there. Dory never disappoints. As though she feels my eyes grazing over her, she glances up and right at me. She snaps the book closed without marking her page and tosses it toward her bag on the floor. Springing from her chair, she's clamping her mouth shut to keep from saying my name and giving my identity away, but her smile is a mile wide. 1 second later, she's in my arms, on her toes, offering her lips up for a kiss. I'm happy to oblige. I wholeheartedly approve of that welcome, I murmur into her mouth, kissing her once more as she regains her composure and recollects where we are. In public. Sweeping her hair back on one side, I cradle her head in my hand and smile down at her now demure expression. Pursed lips, faint blush pinkening the curve of that exposed ear. My voice restrained. Lo, I say, let's go be alone, beautiful girl, or I can ravish you without the audience that bothers only you. I feel her pulse speed under my fingertips and tighten my opposite arm around her, pressing her closer. Or, I'd be happy to back you up against a wall right here, right now, and kiss you breathless, for a start. I'll get my back, she says, her warm breath gushing against my neck. I nod, and she ducks her chin low and steps away to collect her book and bag from the floor, and her sweater from the chair. Shrugging into it, she leads the way down the narrow staircase, across the expanse of main floor, and out the door. I reflect that this may be the only time in my personal history in which I entered a Starbucks and didn't buy anything. Outside at the curb, she pulls to a sudden stop. Oh, did you want something? I arch a brow. Not anything they sell. Let's go see this tiny room of yours, and say hello and goodbye to your very considerate roommate. Glancing up, she bites her lip and smiles at the same time, pulling me across the street to the campus. Her face is a perfect picture of the inner mischievousness with which I'm oh so familiar. Avidly familiar. We don't get far before we're in a thick grove of stories tall trees, which I make a mental note of for some future encounter, when it's warmer. The campus is well lit and well populated for a Saturday night, which makes me feel easier about her being here. No one pays us any mind. We are two more students crossing the campus grounds in search of entertainment. Or privacy. As though I'm playing a character, I immerse myself in a storyline where Dory and I have parallel goals, parallel lives. Where we meet for coffee in between classes, commiserate about professors and assignments, take walks and weekend trips, and lie out in grassy common areas on sunny days. Where we study between makeout sessions, and make love between study sessions. What's the matter? She asks, and I realize I'm frowning. I stop, pulling her fully against me and tip her concerned face up to mine. Absolutely nothing, I say. I just need to do this before we go any further. I lean to kiss her in the semi-darkness. Someone hoots in the distance. At us, or at something unrelated. I don't know or care. I'm always amused by people's reactions when I'm recognized in entirely incongruous, unexpected places from movie star viewing. A State College dorm elevator is, predictably, one of these places. Dory grips my hand when a couple of girls with laundry bags get on. They're whispering while giving me not-so-covert sidelong glances. Wrapping my arms around Dory, I pull her back against my chest and into our own personal space bubble. When the girls exit one floor up and the doors begin to close, they turn back and stare, bug-eyed. I wink, and Dory catches me doing it. The door slides shut, and she smacks my hand where it lays across her abdomen. "You're a bad boy, Reed Alexander." Chuckling, I whisper into her ear, though we're alone now. "Baby, you just wait until I get you into that room. Unless you don't want to wait." Breath catching, she shudders against the length of me, from my thighs to where the back of her head rests under my chin. I close my eyes and breathe through my nose, which only intensifies the cake-sweet smell of her invading my senses. Fucking hell. She has no idea how close she is to me slamming that emergency stop button and backing her into a corner. Then again, maybe she has a very clear idea. Her fingertips stroke my hand, feather light, where she slapped it seconds ago. When we reach her floor, she grabs hold of my hand and makes a sharp right, pulling me into the hallway. We may only have the next 12 hours, but I'm going to make good use of every single one of them.
Dory. Seated at a corner bistro table by the front window of the Starbucks, we wait for the car that will take Reed to the airport. He checks email and messages on his phone, facing away from the other Sunday morning patrons, while I sip my latte and make note of every visually accessible detail of him. It could be weeks before we see each other again, unless he can slip away from his crazy promotion schedule, something he's promised to try to do. The late January sun glints off the waves of his movie star hair, burnished gold with darker natural lowlights. Falling over his forehead, curling over his ears, marginally flattened by the knit cap he wore on the walk from my room. It begs to be touched. His dark lashes, too, are somehow gold-tipped. When those lashes sweep up and his gaze connects with mine, I catch my breath. In the clear morning light, his typically dark blue eyes are vivid enough for me to perceive every individual facet. His irises becoming mosaics of broken sea glass. Angling his head, he says, "What?" I shake my head faintly. "When I didn't like you, the fact that you were so hot played against you." He smirks. "You don't say." Struggling to find the right words, I lean onto my elbows. "If I was already angry at you for something you said or did, I'd look at you and just get angrier. Because it seemed so unfair to be given a face like that and use it for nothing but egocentric causes. I'm guessing that's not how it normally works for you. Or I guess I should say, not normally how it works against you." His mouth pulls up on one side and he shakes his head once. No, that's usually not the case. People find themselves letting you have your way because you're so beautiful that they don't want to deny you anything. I feel so cheap now." "You shouldn't. It's not your fault you were born looking the way you look." He barks a laugh, hand across his mouth, weirdly self-conscious. "Thanks for the sympathy?" "What I mean is, how you look just intensifies everything else about you, which didn't work with me because I was raised to weigh people's actions, to rank them higher than their looks. Superficial people can be swayed by surface beauty alone. It's basic human nature to like pretty things, after all."
"I'm not so sure I'm enjoying the turn of this conversation, to tell you the truth. I feel like I should go rub some dirt on my face, or at least change into polyester plaid."
I shake my head and try again. "When you showed up at Habitat with the cast of Mercy Killing, I'd already experienced firsthand what it was like to be cared for by you. By the time I left that day, I knew what you'd done for Deb. And the knowledge of that beautiful part of you, the real you, apart from your looks, stunned me. But the combination of the compassion you were capable of and your physical beauty right in front of me was so overwhelming." His mouth drops open just slightly, and his brows draw together just as disconcertedly.
"Dory, I'm no angel."
"I know, and I don't expect you to be. You know I like the, I feel the blush creeping over my ears, and with my hair in a messy knot at the nape of my neck, I know that telltale signal is visible. My voice drops to the lowest possible level. "The naughty side of you, too." He takes my hand from the table between us and holds it loosely in his, splayed open, tracing loops on my palm with the tip of his thumb.
Is that why I was able to say a few words I'm not allowed to say in the daylight, when I whispered them to you last night?
His voice is low and rough, dragging something deep inside me to the surface. He leans closer.
When I told you what I was going to do to you before I did it, when I told you what to do to me.
My face floods with heat and memory. I had been beyond shocked to discover that those forbidden words, some of which he's never spoken in front of me, made my body go liquid under his as he whispered them in the dark, his voice husky and demanding. When he sat on the edge of my cramped bed this morning, stretching, his shoulder blades bore the evidence of my enthusiasm, and he seemed to have a bruise or two in curious spots. I was mortified. I hurt you, I said miserably, tracing my fingers over the thin lines on his back. He turned and flattened me against the bed in the space of one blink, his chest pressed to mine, his elbows bearing his weight.
If you ever apologize to me for doing...
He closed his eyes and then flashed them open.
Anything you did to me last night, I'll have no choice but to punish you.
Oh? I whispered, my imagination running rampant. He smiled wolfishly.
In the heat of the moment, it appears we forgot to employ that scarf you were promising to produce. The next time you give me a few hours of your time, Dorcas Cantrell, I think we have a few new things to try.
His soft laugh brings me back to the Starbucks.
I always feel like doing a quick fist pump when I manage to say something that makes you blush well beyond the ears,
he says.
Meanie, you know you love it.
I'm a glutton for punishment, apparently. Another wave of pink descends after I realize I just used the word punishment, and he chuckles again. Tapping a coffee stirrer on the table, he stares at it before sighing.
Dory, what you said about the real me? I'm trying to be a better human being, but I'm still the same guy. People can only change so much.
My heart aches at the truth of those words, and how they apply to the thing I'm dreading most, losing him. But I know he's referring to other, more personally important changes. You underestimate yourself, Reed, as always. You have a good heart, and now your eyes are more open to other people, to suffering you can do something about. All you have to do is not close them again. I know better than anyone that everything isn't fixable. Everything isn't fixable, and miracles are only happy twists of fate. Fate can so easily twist in the opposite direction. I face that fact every time my sister looks right through me. Chapter 13. Brooke.
Brooke, where are you? I heard a rumor that you're in Texas. Is that true?
Janelle's voice is a bit overly screechy before my second cup of coffee. Truthfully, it's screechy all the time. I love her, but Christ, when she's worked up, her voice could pierce steel. I hold the phone a foot away from my ear, only bringing it close to speak.
Okay, what the hell? Where are these rumors coming from? You're the second person who's asked me that. So you aren't in Texas? You and Chandler have multiple promo commitments in the LA area this week, starting tomorrow.
Glenn shuffles into the kitchen, but stops and turns when he hears the voice blaring from the receiver. When I roll my eyes and mouth Janelle, he shakes his head and chuckles. My stepfather is in the oil business. After decades growing his career in the field, he moved into management a few years ago. He's good at his job because he's firm, but easygoing, traits that served him equally well as a stepfather to Kelly and Kylie. All things Hollywood confound and amuse Glenn.
Yeah, Janelle, I know. So I just need to ascertain that you'll be there, she continues, as though I haven't spoken, unless something needs to be rescheduled.
Her tone says that had better not be the case unless someone is dying, namely, me. No rescheduling necessary, Janelle. I had to run home to deal with some family issues, but I'm coming back to LA later today.
Over the rim of his coffee cup, Glenn's brows rise. I shake my head. I'm not ready to spill everything to my agent just yet. Especially knowing that conversation is going to include me telling her that in all likelihood, I'm going to turn down Paper Oceans. She may attempt to have me committed. Oh, thank goodness, Janelle says. I was just telling Amaris. My phone beeps and I check the screen easily since I'm holding it away from my head. Graham. My mouth goes dry and I have to remind myself to breathe. Janelle, I interrupt. Janelle, I've got another call. I've got to take this. I'll call you when I'm home tonight. I'm already grabbing what's left of my tepid coffee and walking back to my room when I flash over. I try and fail to sound composed instead of freaked out. Hello?
Brooke? Emma said you called.
His tone is guarded, noncommittal. But his voice is so very familiar. My eyes fill and I swallow, suddenly at a loss for words.
Brooke?
He repeats. I'm here, I guess. I didn't think you'd call. Thank you.
I just want to know what you want. Don't thank me yet.
Okay. Okay. I take a deep breath. A few weeks ago, I hired an investigator to check on the baby I gave up. Just to make sure he was okay. I was having nightmares about him. I thought if I could find out he's happy and healthy, the nightmares would stop and I could just go on with my life. He makes no comment. The old Graham, in our old friendship, would have asked me some question. But I destroyed that relationship. I killed his trust and his care for me. I close my bedroom door and sit on my bed. I have to do this for River. What I've lost is not of any consequence. He's in foster care. He was removed from his adoptive home by CPS. Hesitantly, he says,
That's what Emma said. Do you know why?
I feel a rush of gratitude for his question, and for the first time I entertain the hope that he'll listen. That maybe, for River's sake, he can stop hating me long enough to not prevent me from getting him. I don't know all of it. I know his adoptive father died, but I don't know how. I know his adoptive mother became a meth addict, and that she went into court-ordered rehab at least twice, and that she failed both times. I know that no relatives have stepped forward to take him. My PI is working on information about them. He's been in foster care for months. Tears are rolling down my face. Bethany Schenck, my PI, gave me a photo of him. When my voice breaks, I hear a soft whoosh of breath from Graham, and I think, please, oh please, don't think I'm faking this. He's so small, and he looks so sad. He needs me, Graham. That's why I applied to adopt him.
What?
I know that he's frowning now, combing his dark hair back with one hand, closing his eyes and shaking his head twice before opening them.
Emma said you told her you were trying to get him out of foster care, but we didn't know what that meant exactly. Adoption, Brooke? You?
I'm trying so hard not to sound like I'm crying. My fingers press against that characteristic pain in my sternum, but nothing soothes the sharp burn of it, like a newly lit match flaring to life just under my skin. Yes, I'm all he's got. It has to be me. He sighs.
It sounds like you mean well. And I can appreciate that you feel responsible for him, believe me. But he needs someone stable, someone devoted to him. He's just a little younger than Kara, right? You have no idea how much energy it requires to look after her, and I have my parents and my sisters. I have Emma.
And you have no one. He doesn't say the words, but they hang there between us, as though he has.
Emma said you wanted a favor?
Yes. His caseworker is going to call you. Maybe his ad litem, too. I don't know what they're going to ask, but please, just don't say anything that will make me lose him. Please, Graham. I count my own heartbeats as they pulse through my ears. 1, 2, 3, 4.
You really want this, don't you? My concern is, why? He's a child, Brooke. He can't fill your need for affection. Children are owed love from their guardians, not the other way around.
I would be offended, but in light of our history and what he knows of me, it's a valid question.
I understand why you'd think that.
But if I'm getting anything from this, it's a sense of doing the right thing. I'm scared. I'm terrified, thinking about all I don't know and everything I could screw up. But he needs me. I have to do this.
What if he has needs you can't fill? What if he's been hurt so badly that you can't help him?
Then I'll get him the help he needs. I'll keep trying. I'm goddamn stubborn, Graham. If nothing else, you know that about me.
I envision the wry, reluctant smile on his face.
Yes, I do.
Reed, I could say I looked for an opening sometime in the 12 hours I spent with Dory to tell her about River. But that would be a lie. And right now my only lie is of omission. I could say that every day that goes by, the guilt is heavier. But that's not exactly true, either. What I feel is fear. Fear that if she finds out, no matter how, from my mouth or someone else's, she won't vacillate. She won't bother with the semantics of telling a lie versus not telling the truth. She'll see in black and white. She'll ignore the gray. This is a girl who seems to have lost a lifelong faith in God. Discarding her tenuous, newfound faith in me would be nothing next to that. Besides, there's a chance that Brooke will change her mind, as slim as that chance may be. Or that someone else will step up and take responsibility for him. That the secret will stay in the closet where secrets belong. And maybe someday, I can tell Dory, when I don't have this feeling that there's a time clock ticking over my shoulder. Or maybe a bomb. I don't want to lose her. She's more important to me than a boy I've never seen. A child I didn't even think was mine biologically until a few weeks ago. I can't be a father, not yet, and maybe never. Dory said I have a good heart. And there is where I find the guilt. By a week prior to the premiere of Mercy Killing, I've been asked by multiple interviewers if I'm dating someone, though they hint about it slyly rather than framing the question plainly to get around the studio's constraint on the subject being broached directly. I give evasive answers and an oblivious smile. Today's interviewer was a little pushier. What's funny is I don't give a shit what the studio wants or doesn't. This is about Dory and her parents, and not giving them reason to hate me for dragging their daughter into my debauched world, as they like to term it. Not that I can argue. I've debauched with dedicated regularity and zeal for years. I have more sympathy now for Emma's ordeal during the school pride promo tour last spring, not only having to deny the existence of her relationship with Graham, but having to pretend one with me at the same time. While I was doing everything in my power to sabotage their relationship. Christ, I was such an asshole. George began negotiating the official stance on my love life with the studio last week, when I made it clear I had no intention of denying my relationship with Dory once it comes to light. And it will, I added. I'm just easing her into the spotlight, along with her parents. So you'll agree to wait until after the release to announce the relationship publicly? He asks now, again. George knows me too well. Yeah, sure. In theory. But if someone shows me a photo of Dory and says, "Is this your girlfriend?" I'm not saying she isn't. I park in the gated lot of Brooke's exclusive complex and let the engine idle while we wrap up. Noted. He clears his throat. One more thing. I've been contacted by a social worker in Texas and asked to pass along a request for you to return the call. Something to do with a court case? He said it involved confidential information that he couldn't discuss with anyone but you. I don't suppose you want to let your manager in on what that's about, if you happen to know? The blood in my veins turns to ice, and my hand grips the gear shift as though it will keep me from being sucked out the open window of my car. Brooke said she wouldn't connect me. But clearly she lied. This is my chance to tell George everything, but I'm immobilized. I don't know. I can give him a call and see what it's about. His sigh reveals his suspicion that I'm withholding something critical. I'll email his information. Give me a call back if there's something I need to oversee. I go from fuming to dumbstruck when Brooke opens her door. Brooke is like my mother in a few ways, one of them being the fact that she always looks as though she could grab a bag and go straight to a club or some posh event without so much as checking the mirror. My mother wears designer clothes around the house. She always has, even when she's drunk. When she was drunk, I correct myself, because it's been so long since I've seen her that way, she was stylish and well-groomed. A little off, but not by much. It's not that Brooke looks off. She's Brooke from 5 years ago. Her hair is pulled into a messy ponytail, tendrils escaping around her face, thin gold hoops dangle from her ears, but she's not wearing makeup. Her eyes are big and blue in her very young face. When we were going out, she would occasionally dig through my dresser drawers and take a pair of jeans, and I was content to let her. She'd ditch whatever trendy pair she was wearing, shimmying out of them while I watched her, breathless, and pull mine on. They'd hang perfectly on her slim hips, fitting her the same way they fit me when I had a boy's body, the one I outgrew a couple of years ago. "Ah," she'd say, dropping onto my bed, "much better." All I could think about was how to get her back out of them. The worn jeans she's currently wearing could be one of the 3 or 4 pairs she appropriated from me back then, though I'm fairly certain she either shredded them with a giant set of shears or burned them in some sorcerous ritual after we broke up. She's barefoot, her toenails polished blood red, and wearing a plain, fitted white t-shirt. Silent, she gestures for me to enter, and I follow her through a maze of boxes and into her living room. I don't remember exactly what her place looked like when I was here last, because I've only been here once, and it's been almost a year. But several things appear to be missing. And then there are the boxes. Frowning curiously, I turn back to her. "Moving?" She nods. "I'll need 2 bedrooms, and most of my decor isn't exactly child-friendly." She says this as though it's normal for such sentences to be said between us, or for the phrase child-friendly to come from her mouth, ever. She perches in a black leather chair and I take its twin. These make up the only furniture in the room, aside from a nearly empty bookcase. I begin first, preempting whatever plan she had for the direction of this conversation. My manager got a call for me from a social worker in Texas. He wouldn't tell George what he wanted, but I'm pretty sure it has to do with you. Or, you know, River. She takes a deep breath, staring at the interlocked hands in her lap, and a distinct feeling of unease creeps over me. "Yes, that's why I asked you to come over," she sighs, and I think, oh no. "I had to tell them." "Excuse me?" "That you're his birth father." My jaw drops. "What do you mean you had to tell them?" Her eyes flash up. "I had to fill out an 18-page questionnaire, Reed. It asked the most personal questions you could imagine, and Norman, my attorney, warned me to be utterly truthful, or I could risk a denial before we even got started. So I told them about my home-wrecking mother and my cheating father, the fact that I was illegitimate because my father was still technically married to Catherine when I was born, the fact that my mother frequently slapped me across the face when I pissed her off, starting so young that I don't remember the first time she did it. I had to reveal my sexual history and experience, all of it. My relationships with my stepfathers and stepmothers and my experience with children, which is, of course, zero." I shake my head. "You keep saying you had to, but that's not true, Brooke. No one is forcing you to do this." She narrows her clear blue eyes and they blaze. "We are done discussing the decisions I'm making concerning my child, Reed Alexander." Backlit by the wall of windows behind her, pale blonde hair haloing her head, she looks like an angel spoiling for a fight. "You're making decisions for me, Brooke. Why can't you see that? I don't have a choice." "You do. Fine. Then I'm choosing our son." My jaw clenches and I stand, hands fisted at my sides. "You've called me his birth father. Now you're calling him my son, like I have some sort of connection with him. I don't. I didn't think he was mine when you turned up pregnant and you knew it. We'd been broken up for weeks by then. I never felt anything about him one way or the other, Brooke, and I don't now. And if that makes me a heartless bastard, then so be it. No, Reed, that's you making him a bastard. My hands both go to the back of my neck and I pull my elbows in, biceps shielding my face like blinders. Pacing between the dozens of boxes littering the floor, I count. 1, 2, 3, 4. I ache to throw something or break something or scream something. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I need to leave. But first, what does the social worker want? She blanches like she'd forgotten about that, and then licks her lips. If her head was transparent, I'd see gears working furiously. A couple of things. They want you to sign a form saying you willingly volunteer to relinquish your parental rights to him. That shouldn't be a problem for you, I gather. It's like clearing a deed to a property, Norman says, so it can transfer easily to a new buyer. She swallows, the muscles in her throat strained. I get the feeling she wants to cry, but isn't allowing herself to do it. So Brooke of her, always calculating something. They might also ask you about our relationship, and the breakup, and the pregnancy, and why I left your name off the birth record, and they're calling people for character references, for me. I laugh once, humorlessly, stuffing my hands into my front pockets. Me? A guy who plea-bargained his way out of a DUI a few months ago as a character reference? I doubt anything I say will hold any weight one way or the other. She shrugs, her expression earnest. I can't stand to look at her, not when she looks so much like she did years ago. I conclude that she must have done this on purpose. But how would she know? How would she know that for months after our breakup, I woke up from dreams of her looking exactly like she does now? Maybe not, she says, but the worst thing would be if they believe I lied and said he wasn't yours, or didn't tell you about him at all. Will you just back me up on that and sign the relinquishment papers, even if you can't say another positive word about me? She did tell me she was pregnant, and even if she let me believe he probably wasn't mine, she never told me he wasn't. I'll back up your story, because it's true, but relinquishment papers? That's a legal declaration, Brooke. I'm back to pacing. The stacks of boxes narrow the walls, constricting the paths between them, paralleling my emotions perfectly. Fuck. My father would kill me if I signed a legal document without his expert guidance. I look back up at her and shake my head slowly. I'm gonna have to tell him. And may God have mercy on my soul.
Chapter 14. Dory. My schedule looks like a sampler platter instead of a meal. Every class I'm taking this semester is preceded by Introduction to, which theoretically makes sense considering I'm a freshman and therefore assumed to be a novice at everything. If I hadn't tested out of reading and comprehension, quantitative reasoning, and 4 semesters of Spanish, I suppose my schedule and I wouldn't look quite so deficient in experience. On a bench in Upper Sproul, I wait with one member of my Intro to Sociology study group for the other two to arrive. The plan was to stake a spot somewhere outside to study, but that was before the sky became completely overcast and the temperature dropped 10 degrees. Claudia scowls down the plaza, looking for Raoul and Afton. "Whose bright idea was it to study outdoors in February? I'm effing freezing." I shrug. "I'm sure they'll agree to go inside. And it was nice out yesterday." "Psh," she says. "It was tolerable, at best. Have you ever noticed how all campus brochures have pictures of happy, smiling students taken on beautiful blue sky days? No matter where the campus is located, Oklahoma, North Dakota, Arizona, whatever. No one is ever huddling into their downfilled North Face jacket, cursing their chapped lips and flyaway hair. No one's ever sloshing across campus in an ugly downpour with no umbrella, a soaked-through backpack, waterlogged shoes, and jeans saturated to mid-thigh. No one's got sweat-stained pits and perspiration-covered faces. Oh, no!
They're throwing a frisbee or studying contentedly on a green lawn in perfect temperatures. They're laughing on the way to the food court or chatting on the steps of the library. I smile. Claudia is one of those people who constantly complains, but she grumbles so humorously that I don't care. She's like a grumpy old lady in an 18-year-old body. A couple of girls suddenly appear in front of us, gazing directly at me, as though I'm about to impart life-saving information. Claudia lifts an eyebrow and looks at me, too.
"Hey," the girl on the left says, "we live in your building, and you were with a guy the other night."
Uh-oh. I recognize them now. The elevator girls. Darn Reed and his winking. I attempt to look blankly at them. Reed's told me what his studio wants, but he's also told me that he doesn't care what I say or do. He says that if someone asks me about him, I can say whatever I'd like. But his premiere is tomorrow night, and I don't particularly want to out myself right here, right now, with strangers. Along with Claudia, the world's most acerbic peace and conflict studies major ever. Girl on the right isn't about to drop this opportunity.
"Was he really Reed Alexander?"
Before I can say a word, Claudia hoots a laugh. "Are you guys high right now? Reed Alexander on campus and no one noticed? Give me a break." Their faces fall. "Oh." Then left side girl rallies. "Then that guy,
he goes here? To Cal?"
I shake my head once. "No, he doesn't. He was just visiting." "Aw," they say in unison, dismayed, and my scowl narrows on them. "And he's my boyfriend." Whoa, where did that tone come from? Unbothered by any sense of diplomacy, left side girl snorts. "He is?" Her friend tries to save face by saying the most awkward thing possible.
"Well, congratulations. I mean, he looks just like Reed Alexander, so obviously he's hot."
Thanks. After they scuttle away, I say, "That was weird." I feel Claudia's eyes on me.
"So you're dating Reed Alexander?"
I look into her dark eyes and my lips part, but no sound emerges. I can't think of a single thing to say.
"Has anyone ever told you that you do not have a poker face?"
Lips twisting, I admit. "Yeah, I may have heard that one a time or two." She angles her head and smiles.
"You're the Habitat girl, aren't you? From last summer."
"Oh, yay. I'd escaped two zealous Reed Alexander groupies, only to find out I'm in a study group with the most dangerous of them all."
"And you're a Reed Alexander fan?"
"Hell no. My little sisters are. They're rabid about him. He seems like a pretentious, untalented asshole to me." I blink. Note I said seems, I haven't actually seen any of his films, and he can't be a total lost cause if he's dating you, I think. Unless you care to refute that.
"Which part?"
She shrugs. "Any of it. I'm open-minded, sort of." I laugh softly as our classmates finally walk up, shivering in their jackets.
"Oh my holy fucking hell," Raoul says. "Can we please go inside to do this?"
"A man after my own heart," Claudia says, bounding from the bench as though released from a spell and walking resolutely in the direction of the library.
"Brr, damn! I never thought I'd say this, but I miss San Diego."
Turning and pointing a finger, she adds, "You guys did not hear me say that." Afton mimes locking her lips and tossing an invisible key over her shoulder.
"We all wanted to get the hell out of somewhere, dude," she says. "But some stuff we take for granted about home just isn't better elsewhere."
Claudia leans closer as we head toward the library. Psychology majors. Jesus. And did she just call me dude? That's so not going to endear her to me anytime soon. I don't care how cute her butt is in those jeans, although she does have a valid point about home and elsewhere. "So, about the pretty boy." I smile and meet her eyes. "He's not a lost cause." She returns my smile.
"Good enough for me."
I have Reed's fan sites bookmarked, so I can watch him from a distance, like everyone else has to. My annoyance is increasing, especially when sites claim proof that he's hooking up with random starlets or singers he stands next to at some event, or a commenting fan proclaims her undying love and desire to have his babies, or someone is trying to figure out who I am and where I'm from and why in the world Reed Alexander would even bother with me. Looking at these pages feels a little stalkerish, too. On the other hand, this is no different than going to friends' Facebook profiles and browsing through photos of them living their lives apart from me. Curiosity is a compelling thing. Where Reed is concerned, I've been curious from the moment he called me a hypocrite for deeming him hopeless, days after we met. With his mother beside him on the red carpet at his premiere, it's a no-brainer where Reed gets his looks. Their coloring is exactly the same, as well as their features, with the exception of the angled jaw bestowed by his father. Lucy Alexander is stunning and elegant, her pride in her son evident in the way she watches him while he signs autographs and leans in to take photos with the beside-themselves fans pressing against the velvet rope. When I came up with the idea of inviting his mother as his plus one, I had a good feeling about it. He was unconvinced that she'd want to go, so I told him the only way he'd know was to ask.
"You'd have thought I just handed her an Oscar," he said later, filling me in on their conversation. "First, she gasped and teared up, and I was thinking, oh great, I've upset her. And then she said, 'Don't you want to take Dory?' So I told her you couldn't get away that night. She stepped forward and hugged me, which she hasn't done in, I don't know, it feels like years. And then she said she'd love to go."
"I told you so," I sing-songed, and he laughed.
"You just live for the times you're able to say that, don't you?"
"Yeah, and lucky for me, with you I get to say it a lot."
"Ha ha, very funny, Miss Cantrell. I'll have to try to hand out those little treats more sparingly. I don't want you to get spoiled."
"Oh, so now you can control the frequency of your wrongness?" I scoffed, trying not to giggle. "How will you do that?"
"Well, I appear to have two choices. I can either be right more often, stop laughing, or I can stop saying things that turn out to be wrong." This is a tough decision.
"Reed. Me. We need to discuss something. In person. Important. Dad. I'll be home tonight by 8. Will that work for you?" Me. "Yes, I'll meet you in your study. I leave for the NYC debut tomorrow morning." Dad is still dressed for work, with the exception of the suit jacket hanging on the peg and padded hanger he had installed for that purpose near the open door. His cufflinks are in a small glass bowl he purchased for the express function of holding cufflinks. His red pattern tie remains knotted but loose, and his shirt sleeves are rolled to mid-forearm. I knock my knuckles twice to announce my presence, and his eyes snap up from the paperwork he's scanning. He pushes it aside and collects a pad and pen.
"Reed, come in."
After I take a deep breath and sit, he says,
"All right, what's going on?"
Every careful, premeditated introduction to the grenade I'm about to toss into the room has flown out of my brain. Entire, perfectly crafted explanations are just gone. I'm thinking in words like a toddler, or Tarzan. Me, father. You, grandfather. Help. I look him in the eye, and he's frowning, waiting for me to state my business. I haven't been scared of my father since I was 10. Intimidated, yes. Demeaned, yes. Afraid, no. Is this what his clients feel like, sitting across the desk from him? And that's when it hits me. No, this isn't what it feels like to be his client. He doesn't frown at his clients. He may wear a veneer of concern. He may even be concerned. But the face I'm seeing, the eyes I'm looking into now, he's alarmed. Apprehensive. Worried. His clients don't get that puckered brow expression. My mother does. And I do. I rub my clammy palms against my jeans. "I have a problem. And I need your advice. Your legal advice." He takes a breath through his nose and his brow clears the slightest bit. He's still on alert, but he knows this crisis is in his territory, whatever it is, and I've brought it to him before someone else did. That's possibly unprecedented.
"I'm listening,"
he says. I take another deep breath. You remember Brooke? He grimaces. Brooke Cameron? I nod, and he answers, Yes, I remember her. Grenade time. After we broke up, pull the pin, toss. She found out she was pregnant. I expect him to speak, start sputtering or roaring, something. Eyes drilling into mine, he goes a little pale around the edges, but he holds his fire. He recognizes that there's some reason I've brought this to him, and I haven't voiced it yet. He hasn't scribbled so much as a stroke on that pad. Swallowing, I continue. She had the baby and gave it up for adoption. A few weeks ago, she hired a PI to look for him. She found him, in foster care, and now she wants to adopt him. She wants me to sign relinquishment papers. I want to make sure I'm not missing something before I do it. He begins to write on the pad, and I sit, waiting. Several minutes later, he begins to fire questions at me, one after the other. After each one, there's a prolonged pause as he logs my answer. Did she tell you she was pregnant at the